Programming is supported by Topline Construction Firm, your local women-owned roofing contractor based out of Shoreview, Minnesota. Roof replacement, both retail and insurance work. More information at toplineconstructionfirm.com.
Good morning, I'm Carrie Miller. This is NPR News, and now we're in depth on what we're learning about President Trump's foreign policy. 1 month into Donald Trump's tenure, and his foreign policy leadership appears to be contradictory and often controversial. Russia, China, Taiwan, Mexico, Iran, and the NATO alliance have all been the subject of conflicting statements and policies. Today, we're going to ask whether it's unusual for a commander-in-chief to reconsider campaign foreign policy promises once he's in office. But we're also going to begin with the latest revelations regarding Russia, Michael Flynn, and the Trump campaign and presidency. And as our guests join us this morning, I want to hear from you on this. If you voted for the president, is there a top foreign policy commitment that he made that you want him to fulfill? If you didn't vote for Donald Trump, if you didn't support the president as a candidate, is there a foreign policy issue you are most concerned about? So as a supporter, he made a lot of promises regarding foreign policy. I'd like to hear from you this morning on if there are one or two that are most important for you to see him fulfill. And if you didn't, are there some things that he is saying about foreign policy that you are most concerned about? Here's the phone number on that, 651-227-6000, 800-242-2828. I'm on Twitter, at Carrie NPR. David Shanzer is our guest this morning. He's director of the Triangle Center on Terrorism and Homeland Security at Duke University, and he's with us today from Durham, North Carolina. David, welcome back to the show. Good to talk to you again.
Thank you so much for having me.
Molly O'Toole is with us. She's a senior reporter at Foreign Policy Magazine, and she's with us today from D.C. And Molly, welcome back. It's good to talk to you again, too.
You as well.
David, I want to break apart a bit of this reporting that's been going on overnight and this morning from The Times on Russia. But what we're learning about this is that during the year that Donald Trump was campaigning for president, it now appears that his team was in contact with Russian intelligence officials. Here's my question about this. If Donald Trump had not been speaking warmly of Vladimir Putin and had not taken a significantly different approach to Russia than other candidates and other politicians, would that have been alarming to American intelligence officials, and would we be talking about it today?
Well, it's a fine question. I don't think we know the answer to that. You know, lots of phone calls with people that we know are Russian intelligence agencies would be recorded because that's what we do. I mean, we spy on Russia, agents of foreign powers. So it could be that lots of these calls were intercepted in the course of business. And now, since there's so much question about the Russian hack of the election, so many investigations that are going on, both in the criminal sphere and in the intelligence sphere, that, you know, we have these recordings. So that could be why this is coming up. I don't think that the intelligence agencies were necessarily targeting individuals in the Trump campaign to see who they were talking with. That would be not the way we usually do intelligence collection, unless there's some sort of criminal allegation.
So, Molly, so hearing what David has said about this, and hearing that the administration is saying there was nothing illegal in what Flynn did in these conversations with Russian officials, the similar question to you, would we be concerned if we were not aware that Donald Trump apparently feels quite differently about Russia and Putin than many of his fellow politicians?
Well, I think one way we can look at this is in some of the great reporting that's been done on this, that the after the election, after Donald Trump had already won, obviously during the election, we saw a lot of very friendly statements from Donald Trump members of, or soon to be members of his administration towards Russia, including the comments where Donald Trump encouraged the Russians, if they had Hillary Clinton's emails, to publish those. What we see from the reporting is that the Obama administration, who was already looking into what role Russia may have played in the elections after the revelations about hacking of the DNC and others, they started to become very concerned when, around the announcement of the sanctions that were responding to that meddling in the election, they became aware of some of these phone calls that had occurred. And then that was really when the alarm started, to try and piece together, okay, well, what was the nature of those conversations? Was there a quid pro quo? Now, they were assured by the FBI at that time that there was not. Mm-hmm. But that just sort of goes to show that if those friendly statements hadn't been made during the campaign, as some of these revelations started to emerge about the Russian-backed meddling in the election, this may have been perceived as very different. But now it's certainly seen as Flynn's resignation is just seen as the tip of the iceberg. We even see this with Republican senators saying that this certainly needs to be a focus of the larger investigation that's been going on into Russia's role in the election.
Okay. And Molly, a follow on that. A man named Alexander Bortnikoff holds the title of director at the FSB, which is the successor to the KGB. But are these investigations, do you think, going to be able to determine whether, when there were contacts with Russian intelligence officials, what this really means is that there is contact with Putin, perhaps at a remove, but that because of the nature of the way Russia is run by Putin, there would have been, you know, contact and conversation going on, even if it's at a distance with Putin?
Well, I think we can even see that just from the intelligence community's public statements that they've made about their investigation into the election meddling. They said that it's senior level Russian officials that would have had to approve, order, coordinate, or at least been aware of that campaign on the Russian actors' part to meddle in the election. So while I think discovering, some written down order that said, if you could please do this, sincerely, Vladimir Putin, is not going to happen. I think we're well aware of the way the Russian government works. As you said, it would be unlikely that this sort of activity would be going on without at least some knowledge on the part of senior level Russian officials.
David, overall, what raises concerns for you about it? You see the investigations are going to happen. You see a lot of discussion and the response from the Trump administration. As you watch this unfold, what are some of the questions that come up for you that you feel like we really need to have answered?
Well, if you go back and start right from the beginning, the whole relationship and the fondness that Trump has continued to express throughout the campaign and into the beginning of his presidency has really not made much sense. Here is a candidate who wanted to try to take on the mantle of Ronald Reagan, the staunch anti-communist. Russian activities over the past year, taking Crimea, invading parts of Ukraine, a sovereign country in the heart of Europe, Eastern Europe, but still in Europe, taking a very aggressive posture in Syria and the Middle East, contrary to U.S. interest in many regard, and an alliance with Iran, which we consider the biggest threat in the Middle East. If you take all those things together, why this kind of strange, friendly relationship, why this coddling of Russia? And that just raises so many questions. Is it about business? Is it about information that he fears that the Russians have about him, the so-called dossier? So that really starts us off down this path. And then you add once they've become in office or once elected, these actual discussions of a relief of sanctions, undercutting something that President Obama did relating to the election, and of course the Russian hack of the election and the leaks of these emails, which was one of many factors that led to Trump winning. So that is a very big ball of wax, and there are, literally dozens of leads and questions to follow there. A good way to start off a presidency.
Molly, hearing David lay all that out, the ball of wax, again, at the center of that is why Donald Trump behaves the way he does around Russia. Short of President Trump, being more forthcoming on his thinking on this, is it clear to you that we will ever really get an answer on that?
In terms of him being more forthcoming on his thinking of this, I think the implication of that question is that there is a deeper thinking on this. I mean, it's really difficult to sometimes to apply a logic to Donald Trump's foreign policy. Mm-hmm. I mean, we can see that just looking at his phone calls with various leaders. So in terms of that answer, I think you're right. It may be difficult to ever get that answer because I'm not sure if there is one. I mean, certainly the way that Donald Trump has articulated consistently when he's gotten pushback about why be so friendly towards Russia, here are all the things they're doing around the world to resist U.S. influence or to resist there being a resolution to the conflict in Syria, for example, to meddle in Eastern Europe in their and European elections as well. The justification he's given is that Russia is a power. They're involved in all of these conflicts that the U.S. has an interest in resolving. And if they can be a partner in some areas, why not pursue that partnership with Russia? And particularly we see that in his articulation of that with the fight against the Islamic State, acknowledging the reality that Russia has to be involved in any sort of resolution to that conflict because they're there and they're one of the primary backers of Bashar al-Assad. So if you want a resolution to that conflict, then you would need to involve Russia in some way. That's the sort of strongest logic that he's given for that approach to Russia. But in terms of his broader strategic thinking on foreign policy, I mean, it changes so often. It's constantly contradictory. It's very selective. It doesn't really ascribe to any traditional box of U.S. Foreign policy. So it's difficult to know.
And that is what Molly just articulated there is exactly what the essence of our conversation is this morning, although we have begun starting out talking about these newest revelations around Russia. But it's trying to apply some kind of comprehension and logic to President Trump's foreign policy approach. And that's why we invited Molly O'Toole from Foreign Policy and David Shanzer from the Triangle Center at Duke to the show today to try to understand what do we hear, what do we understand about the way President Trump approaches what he says, how he's acting, how he's thinking on foreign policy, starting out again on Russia here, but we're going to look at some other parts of the world. And as you have questions this morning, if you voted for the president, is there a top foreign policy commitment that he made during the campaign that you want him to fulfill? If you did not support President Trump, are there foreign policy discussions, commitments that he's making, policy decisions that he's making that you're most concerned about? Here's an opportunity to weigh in, and we'll bounce that off of our guests. 800-242-2828, 651-227-6000, on Twitter, at Kerri, KERRI NPR, and to the phones here to Jean in Ashland, Wisconsin. Jean, thanks so much for waiting. I know we took a bit there on Russia, but I appreciate it. What are you thinking about?
No problem. Thank you for your time.
Sure.
A couple of things. I think trying to figure out Trump's ideas on foreign policy is difficult. I did vote for him with reservation for a couple of reasons, and I won't waste your time with that part. But I think the fact that we had, it's not the same, but a lack of understanding when Obama was in office and doing his apology tour as a way of building rapport with other countries that certainly raised eyebrows. And I felt that was unusual and not a common practice that the U.S. ever gotten into before. Trump's approach to negotiating or future negotiations, maybe this is an angle he's working on, I'm not sure. But I think from our standpoint as a citizen of this country, the other half of my concern which Trump is addressing, is the immigration and the border security, mainly because of the drug trafficking around the world and how it influences and has a direct impact on our society on a day-to-day basis. On law enforcement, and it's horrendous, the amount of trafficking that goes on, and it's on the rise times four in the last few years alone, and that doesn't seem to be covered much.
Gene, two good things there, and thanks very much for the call. So, David, to the first part of what Gene said, and he referred to some of the connections that President Obama made in other foreign capitals as an apology tour, and I know there are many people who believe that. You see a very different approach, a more pugnacious approach, perhaps, from President Trump. Do we know what the fruits of that will be yet? It's early to tell, isn't it?
Well, it's early to tell, but some of the early returns really aren't very good. Let's take, for example, in China, where President Trump, even before he was elected, committed a major diplomatic faux pas or foul by essentially trying to reverse 30 years of U.S. history on the One China policy. So this was the idea, well, if I'm blusterous, if I, you know, if I show I'm going to be a disruptor, that will give me bargaining leverage. Well, it turned out that the Chinese president essentially iced him out of any sort of conversations and would not even begin the relationship with this new administration until Trump reversed his position on
that. Interesting.
And then he had to, and he did. And that essentially showed American weakness. So bluster can sometimes backfire on you.
And Molly, the other thing that Gene brought up is the drug enforcement and securing the borders. And I think Gene specifically mentioned the southern border. I've been thinking about unintended consequences of this adversarial approach to Mexico. If you need cooperation on an issue like drug trafficking, you need that from Mexico. And at the moment, Mexico may be in kind of a similar position of where China is, not really interested in cooperating with the United States the way they might have during the Obama administration. What might be the unintended consequences of that?
Well, that's a really, really good point. I mean, we saw a lot of the reporting that happened with Trump's phone call with the Mexican president, with Peña Nieto, and this threat that the White House claimed was made in jest, where he said, your military isn't doing enough on the drug problem and combating these cartels, and we may send our U.S. military down there to do it. But what it really highlighted for me is, as it's an excellent point that you just made, is actually how much leverage Mexico has in this relationship. We constantly hear Donald Trump talking about, no, we're going to build a wall. We're going to make Mexico pay for it. Basically, we're going to start this tariff war with Mexico, despite them being, you know, one of our largest trading partners. But Mexico, especially under the Obama administration, even before that, has really emerged as a significant partner for the United States for that security relationship. And in order to combat drug trafficking, to stem illegal immigration, which, by the way, is at net, you know, it's actually reversed. There are more people going back to Mexico than are coming in. So it's a really good thing to point out when we sort of get all this rhetoric around illegal immigration. But we really rely on them to do this. And if Mexico were to say one day that they're going to stop helping the U.S. in this regard, it would really be devastating for those issues at the southern border. For one quick example, the Obama administration pursued Plan Frontera Sur, which basically provides a lot of funding and logistical support for the Mexican government to essentially step up their own enforcement of immigration that comes through their country, Mexico being used as a transit country for a lot of Central American migrants and really migrants from all over the world who take that land route to try and get to the United States. So Mexico has their own deportations and detentions, particularly at their southern border, have skyrocketed. And the logic being that if they stop them there, then they won't reach the southern border of the United States. So the U.S. really has a vested interest in them keeping up that security relationship. If they were to decide to stop doing that enforcement, perhaps would see much more of a presence on the southern border, which is exactly what Donald Trump says he doesn't want.
Yeah, David, one more. While we're lingering on Mexico here for a moment, the other thing that I was thinking about is if President Trump talks about penalizing American companies for you know, adding more jobs in their factories in Mexico. I mean, one of the unintended consequences that I wonder if he's considered is that fewer people will find jobs in Mexico, more will want to come to the States, he'll have a bigger undocumented immigration problem on his hands. It just seems like when we talk about applying logic, you know, even the economic logic of this does not make sense. I mean, maybe you can provide some insight on this.
You've got it exactly right. You know, I think if you wanted to have one descriptor for the Trump foreign policy overall, it would be incoherence. And that's what you have here. Are the key drivers of illegal immigration in Mexico would be lack of economic opportunity and the birth rate. And what we've seen literally over the past decade, post-NAFTA, which has been in place for 20 years now, is more prosperity in Mexico, declining birth rates, and therefore reduced migration from Mexico. So if you want to increase the flow of illegal immigrants, then damage the Mexican economy, damage the peso, stop having economic growth, new companies, new factory jobs. That's what will increase the flow of migrants for sure.
You know, I want to say one thing, though, here, and this goes back to China. And Michael, I think, or David, I think you brought this up, and I'm hearing from Michael on Twitter and some others who are raising this. You know, Donald Trump changed his mind, actually, reversed a publicized policy on China. And he appears to have done that in conversations with, you know, his national security team, his secretary of state, perhaps others that he trusts. That's a quality, David, that it sounds like you'd like to see more of, and that I think we should acknowledge. He did reverse himself on that. Maybe it was even up against the wall, but maybe he trusts this team around him and they can have more influence than we think. What do you think?
Well, certainly, I think getting Rex Tillerson into the State Department and General Kelly, General Mattis, you know, very experienced people with a lot of global understanding to start advising him, as opposed to simply the people who were running his campaign. And they did a great job on their campaign, but they weren't ready to run U.S. foreign policy. So I agree, that's a big improvement. But what I would say, and you know, with the departure of the National Security Advisor, one of the other distinguishing characteristics of this administration is a very chaotic policymaking process. You have multiple power centers. Obviously, you have the normal set, the National Security Advisor. Then you have Trump himself, who does things independently through his tweets that then staff have to try to respond to and understand and communicate to foreign governments. And finally, his family, Jared Kushner, seems to have an independent portfolio. So how do you bring coherence when you have essentially three different policymaking processes within the White House and the federal government?
You know, Molly, I was reading, I think it was one of the Times or the Post was quoting Jeffrey Bauer, who advised President Obama on China, and said, Bauer gave this quote to the paper, "During the transition, no one had the nerve or the expertise to contradict him meaning Trump. That's why I take some measure of, well, if he has a team around him, you know, and there is some experience in that team, maybe they can reason with him, you know, to bring more coherence to this foreign policy. Have you seen an indication of that at all? We are less than a month in, but I'd like your view on that. Molly, are you there?
Yes.
Okay.
Can you hear me?
Yes. Go right ahead.
Okay. I don't know that observers should comfort themselves necessarily with this sort of constant question of, will Trump moderate, President Trump moderate his views, or will the people around him who do have more experience, the quote-unquote adults in the room, be able to moderate his views. Like David said, there are a lot of competing power centers within the administration. Some of the traditional processes for policymaking or policy review have broken down or aren't being used, whether because a lot of these positions remain unfilled or because of the sort of disruptive mandate that they feel that they've gotten. For example, with Defense Secretary Mattis, with General John Kelly. I mean, there have been a few examples in which we've seen that they've been either steamrolled or don't appear to be having this moderating influence that many people, including Republican members of Congress, were hoping that they would have. I mean, just one quick example. I mean, we can see with the executive order that temporarily barred refugees and barred most travelers, including legal permanent residents, at least initially, from seven Muslim-majority countries. The swirl of reports is still ongoing in terms of how that actually came about. I mean, many of that reporting indicated that those key players, Mattis, Kelly, didn't have input for that order, didn't see it before it came out. Now we've seen that be blocked by the courts and Trump potentially suggesting he's going to rewrite that. Then again, with other executive orders we've seen the drafts of, they haven't come down, but drafts those executive orders, for example, one on interrogation and detention, potentially reviewing whether or not the U.S. would bring back torture, whether the CIA would once again be detaining individuals. We've seen later drafts of that executive order that removes that language that seems to indicate that they are actually including key players at the Departments of State, Department of Defense, and listening, taking their feedback, that's removing some of those more controversial language. So are there indications that, yes, those processes, those traditional processes are starting to be used? Yes. At the same time, I think we can see Flynn's resignation as just an example of continued dysfunction within the National Security Council, continued competition, leaks, backstabbing, rivalries. And moving forward, I think we're going to continue to see a sort of inconsistent application of foreign policy due to some of those challenges that remain.
Mary says on Twitter, his blatant disregard for any and everything that doesn't suit his whim in the moment, that's her concern about the foreign policy approach. Chris in Minneapolis called to say, Trump's personality is the biggest challenge to foreign policy. He's irrational. We might not have allies by the end of the year. It's frightening, especially with North Korea. We'll talk about North Korea, but I also want to come back to Molly and David on this idea of how a president's personal demeanor, right, how a personality might really influence our larger foreign. I mean, there's a big bureaucracy around foreign policy. Does a president's personality really matter? So we'll talk about that as well. 651-227-6000, 800-242-2828 on Twitter. At Kerry, KerriNPR. Back in just a minute, going to Mike Mohn now with news. Hi, Mike.
Hello, Kerry. Good morning. President Donald Trump is responding to the fallout from his national security adviser, Michael Flynn, resigning over Flynn's pre-inauguration conversations about sanctions with the Russian ambassador. Trump tweeted this morning that a Russia connection is, quote, nonsense, and he says, quote, the fake news media is going crazy, unquote. Senate Minority Leader Charles Schumer has called a meeting of Democratic senators to discuss the resignation of Michael Flynn and published reports about contacts between President Trump's campaign and Moscow. Another leading Democrat, Illinois Senator Dick Durbin, is pressing the Democrats' case for an independent investigation, as is Minnesota Senator Amy Klobuchar. Two senior Palestinian officials say CIA Chief Mike Pompeo secretly held talks in the West Bank with Mahmoud Abbas yesterday. It's the first high-level meeting between the Palestinian leader and a Trump administration official. Today, President Trump meets with Israeli leader Benjamin Netanyahu at the White House. Big gains in consumer prices and retail sales are sending bond prices lower and yields higher in early trading on Wall Street. Bank stocks rose, but most other stocks fell. Stocks began the day at record highs, with the S&P coming off a sixth straight day of gains. Right now in the Twin Cities, we have partly sunny skies, 21 degrees, the current temperature. More news ahead on Minnesota Public Radio News. It's 9:37.
Later on All Things Considered, the attorneys for St. Anthony police officer Geronimo Yanez are presenting their argument to dismiss the case in the shooting of Philando Castile. I'm Tom Cran. We'll have the latest on that and all the day's news when you join me here starting at 3.
Have you had a chance to catch Indivisible, our public radio national call-in show? Tonight, it's Republican contrarian conservative Charlie Sykes at 7 o'clock. Tomorrow night, I'm back on the air at 7 o'clock, and I'm talking about identity and elites. You heard Donald Trump talking a lot about elites. How does that inform our idea of who we are as Americans? That's Indivisible at 7 o'clock. I'd love you to listen in and call in.
I'm Tom Weber. Coming up during the 11 o'clock hour here on NPR News, we'll be taking live coverage from NPR, President Trump's news conference with the Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu. Again, that's happening during the 11 o'clock hour. We'll have analysis from NPR and here locally as well. Tune in.
Programming is supported by the Shakopee Mattawakaton Sioux community, which donates millions of dollars each year to provide scholarships, protect the environment, and improve health and safety in Minnesota communities. Learn more at ShakopeeDakota.org.
We're back to our conversation and trying to understand what appears to be an often contradictory and controversial foreign policy in the early days of the Trump administration. We asked Molly O'Toole, she's a senior reporter at Foreign Policy, and David Shanzer, director of the Triangle Center on Terrorism and Homeland Security at Duke University, to give us their insight and their views. And then I'm asking you this morning that as you watch this foreign policy unfold, are there issues, foreign policy issues, as a supporter of President Trump's that you really want to see him fulfill? How worried are you about this lack of cohesiveness, as we've been hearing from our guests on foreign policy? And I'm going to grab a call here from Brenda, because I also want to talk about the president's personal behavior as it applies to foreign policy. And Brenda in Woodbury, it sounds like you have some thoughts on that, Brenda. You have a question around that.
I sure do.
Okay. What is it?
Thank you.
Sure.
I believe it's absolutely essential to ask the right questions. And so what Donald Trump thinks is an irrelevant question. I look at behavior patterns, and what I see is that he uses manipulation. He is a master at doing that by whatever means are needed. The saying the best defense is a strong offense, he does that in spades.
Mm-hmm.
What matters is what he says or what he does or gets caught at. So, for example, I see him as a master at denying, justifying, deflecting, flipping to blame the accuser.
Okay.
And I am so extremely grateful to the media for exposing him and his behaviors, his actions.
Okay, Brenda, let me do this. It's a good point. Yeah, thanks for the call. And so, Molly, let me come back to you that in the overall, as I noted before we went to news, there's a big bureaucracy. You've got Congress. You have checks and balances. How much does a president's personal behavior matter to our associations and our foreign policy?
It matters hugely. Foreign policy, in particular national security, are the areas in which the executive has the most power. The Constitution is written that way, and the courts and Congress tend to be pretty deferential to that executive power to determine foreign policy. Certainly the bureaucracy or the structure of the White House can determine to what extent the president is directing that policy. But I think Donald Trump actually is challenging that not unilateral, but certainly powerful control over foreign policy more than any other president in recent memory. I mean, we have foreign policy being conducted by Twitter, him responding in real time to what lawmakers are doing, various foreign leaders are doing. And I think as personality driven as the presidential campaign was. That's what we're seeing in U.S. foreign policy being driven by Trump's personality. I mean, we can see even just in his phone calls with foreign leaders, typically those would require, you know, extensive briefing, being very cautious about the language that's being used, because in those personal interactions, they not only set the tone for the relationship with that country for the rest of the administration, but those even the words that are exchanged can be very loaded. I mean, they can spark a diplomatic incident. And what we saw from the Trump administration, what you would think would be a sort of run-of-the-mill call with one of the United States' closest allies, Australia, that was a call that was cut short, in which Donald Trump got very upset about an agreement that was made under the Obama administration to take refugees. So I think that's just a perfect example of how Donald Trump's personality, his well-documented tendency towards pugnacity, can really impact a relationship.
And yet, David, I mean, we talked about China a few minutes ago. You know, for all the things that he said and, you know, what he said was going to be his disruptive approach to Taiwan and China, as both of you have noted, he got back in line because there's a lot more at stake than he obviously was taking into account when he was talking about China. And I just wonder, you can appear to be one way and be personality driven, as he clearly is, but there's a lot of forces forcing you back into a somewhat traditional approach, aren't there?
Absolutely. And that is because I think on the campaign and in his worldview, that if there's bluster and strength and maybe even shows of military force, an idea that other countries will simply bend to our will. And I think, first of all, that is just wildly inaccurate view of the way the world is today. There's many, many more power centers. Obviously, first, it used to be us and the Soviet Union, and then the Soviet Union disappeared, and we were the major power. But in the 20 years since that has happened, other countries are able to assert themselves much more strongly. And so countries are going to respond, and our leverage is not as great as President Trump perhaps assumed before he took office. We're going to do things, and then a lot of other countries are going to react in ways that are going to be troublesome for us. So I think there's an overestimation to the extent that threats, bluster are going to actually influence how other countries act.
Jeff says online, I'd like to see NATO countries honor their agreements to spend 2% of their GDP on defense. If countries don't adhere to that rule, then there should be some penalty through NATO. And of course, that's something that General Mattis is in Europe right now talking to NATO allies about. I also want to ask you both about this deal with Iran. Sure not hearing much about that after we heard a lot about it during the campaign. Donald Trump said that it was the worst agreement ever, worst deal ever struck. He was going to tear it up, withdraw from it. We had a foreign policy roundtable a couple of weeks ago, and two of our guests said, that's bluster. I don't believe he's going to do it. The first that you're going to hear is law professor John Ratzen, who has also served as assistant counsel to the CIA. Listen to what he has to say.
One area where Trump is not going to fulfill his campaign promise, he's not going to rip up the deal with Iran. He's looking at it. People are advising him. Even Netanyahu is not making that much noise in Israel about how this deal needs to go.
Okay, so that's John Ratzen. Here's Peter Galbraith, who is a former U.S. ambassador, and he agreed with John Ratzen. Listen.
I was in Iran at the time the deal was being negotiated. The debate in Iran had very little to do with the United States. It was really an issue between the hardliners and the supreme leader on one hand, and Rouhani, the president, and Zarif, the foreign minister, on the other. Because when you go beyond that and look at the merits, and all of those debates are overtaken by events, the deal makes a lot of sense.
David, what do you think?
Well, I agree with both of your prior guests. Politically, it made for great rhetoric that riled up his base. Obviously, Iran has been an adversary for many decades, and Iran acts irresponsibly. But what this deal did is it iced its nuclear ambitions for 15 years. And that enables us to try to confront Iran and also modify its behaviors in other ways during that period. I just saw some discussions that the Saudi Arabia and Iran have opened up some discussions on how to deal with some of their regional issues. You know, if Iran was within weeks of obtaining a nuclear weapon, you know, that would have never happened. So I think in office, Trump has taken a look at this, and his advisors well know that despite the politics and the hot rhetoric about the deal, that it was, while not perfect, no agreement is perfect, it advanced U.S. national security interests and therefore was worth keeping.
Call here, Molly, for you from Craig in Nisswa. Hey, Craig. Hi.
Hey, how's it going?
Going well. Tell me what you're thinking about.
Well, one of your callers made a comment about how she was so happy that the media is being so critical of Trump and sort of keeping on top of him.
Right. That was Brenda. Uh-huh.
And I guess I feel like it's really strange that, President Obama deported more illegal immigrants than any other president.
Yep.
And
deportations went up. That's right.
On more countries than any other president. So I feel like there's kind of a lot of hypocrisy in both society and the media, both in who they're willing to criticize and for what.
Yeah. Molly, I'm going to take that to you because the deportations is, Craig is absolutely right on his facts. I don't know about the bombing more countries than any other president. But overall, his point about how we're the standard that we're right. using to judge President Trump.
Right. I mean, absolutely, the media's, but I guess part of my response would be that the media's job is to be critical of whoever's in the White House. I feel strongly that is what the media is doing. Absolutely. In any story covering immigration, it should be noted that President Obama deported more people than any other president, broke records for doing so, received a lot of criticism from the left. For doing so, the deporter in chief is the sort of disparaging title that he was given. At the same time, if you look at it, and this is just sort of representing both sides in terms of reporting, President Obama got a lot of criticism from the right for saying that he didn't enforce immigration laws, and we've heard that from Donald Trump throughout the campaign. We've continued to hear that from his Homeland Security Secretary John Kelly, from members of the administration who are saying that these actions they are taking now, whether it's the executive order on immigration, the several of the executive orders that address immigration, the deportation raids that we've started to see, more than 600 people detained in last week alone. They're saying that's because the Obama administration was so weak on the borders and didn't enforce immigration law. But obviously, we know about those record deportations. We know about record money that was spent on the border increases there. So there are ways in which these things are used politically. But I think and I'll wrap this up, sort of rambling here, but part of what we may be seeing in the criticism of the media that they're sort of being unfairly critical of the Trump administration, first of all, it's the media's role to be critical of whoever's in the White House. But it's because particularly on foreign policy, some of these things that we're seeing, the way the Trump administration is operating, the comments that Donald Trump are making are unprecedented. They're outside of the norm of how U.S. foreign policy is conducted in a way that many see as troubling and having sort of grave implications for the stability of the international community. So if the president is making these comments and these comments are being recorded and put into context, is that being unfairly critical of the administration, or has the administration sort of brought it upon itself, so to speak?
You know, David, I want to come back on that, though, and I'm hoping Craig is still listening here. I mean, Donald Trump made no bones about the fact that he was going to be a disruptor. It's part of the reason that he got the number of votes that he got and why there is still a certain very loyal group of his base who are happy with a lot of what he's doing. So is there anything wrong with saying, with laying that over the approach to trying to judge what he's doing again in very early days of the administration? We're dealing with something we haven't seen before. Maybe we need to take more of an understanding of what it really means to be a disruptor?
Well, I think a lot of his support came from a notion that the government had not provided for a sector of the population that it was his core base. It had not produced rising incomes. It had not produced what they saw as a less expensive healthcare system. It had not produced opportunities for advancement for their children. And so, yes, his character as a disruptor appealed to them because they were so angry and so disillusioned from the federal government and what they saw as the Washington establishment.
Right.
But I don't think that meant disrupting the entire international order. And I think that those people will be very disappointed to see incompetence in government, our allies moving away from us, economic retribution being taken against us. And those are all the things that can happen when you disrupt an international order that we constructed in the post-World War II era and has really advanced our interest in both security and economic prosperity more so than any country in the world. So that is really what is at stake here.
Todd and Ramsey called to say, until Trump supporters are ready to admit the problems that we've had in the first 30 days, we can't go anywhere. Your first caller was an example of this. He called out Obama's issues, but calls Trump's position pragmatic. To Mike in Miltona. Hey, Mike, thanks so much for waiting.
Oh, you're welcome. My comment is just that foreign policy seems to be so intrinsically linked to foreign aid and with military aid and a heavy emphasis on the military aid, that when we spend money on the military aid, it comes back to the U.S. anyway. However, because of Trump's business, he seems to be irked about spending money and not getting anything for it.
Mm-hmm.
And so I have this strange hope. I mean, it's a distant hope that maybe he could make some sort of a difference in foreign policy by changing the emphasis from basically war to peace and not being the military policeman of the country.
Okay. Molly, that's interesting. What do you think?
Well, I think that does get at one of the interesting things about Donald Trump's foreign policy. On the one hand, he has been extremely critical of, at least during the campaign, at various points he supported conflicts and didn't support conflicts and so on. But during the campaign, at least, and continuing in his presidency, has criticized the Obama administration, the State Department under former Secretary of State Hillary Clinton, for being too interventionist, for getting the U.S. involved in these expensive conflicts that he didn't see as advancing U.S. interests, and sort of being the military, being the policeman for the world, rather than putting America, quote unquote, America first. And so has suggested that he's going to review military alliances such as NATO and the U.S. investment in NATO if NATO partners didn't do more to sort of invest their own spending. So that's sort of an anti-interventionist, sort of neo-isolationist mindset, the America First foreign policy. On the other hand, he's also talked about really ramping up military spending, expanding the military in a way that we haven't seen since sort of that arms buildup under President Ronald Reagan, really getting more involved in the ISIS fight. That's sort of the tip of the spear of his that other side of his foreign policy, which really indicates a much greater investment, military involvement in some of these conflicts around the world. We've also seen them sort of lay the groundwork potentially for more involvement in Yemen, for example, which has sort of been the graveyard of ambitions for many a country for some time. So there really does seem to be this sort of contradiction, and without this sort of strong consistency in terms of articulation of foreign policy, it can seem like an inconsistency or a contradiction rather than a sort of strategic thinking. But the caller raised a really good point in sort of highlighting that what seems to be two different directions that the foreign policy is being pulled in.
Molly, really grateful for your insight and the time this morning. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Molly O'Teal, senior reporter at Foreign Policy. David, thank you. We really appreciate it when you can make yourself available to us. I'm grateful for the insight. Thank you.
Well, I love being on your show. Thank you so much.
We love having you. David Shanzer is director of the Triangle Center on Terrorism and Homeland Security at Duke. Nicholas says on Twitter, a transactional approach to foreign policy works with a neutral personality, not an ego-driven personality. Coming up on Indivisible tonight at 7 o'clock, you'll hear Charlie Sykes, someone who calls himself a contrarian conservative, talking about the latest news and taking your calls nationwide. And then tomorrow night at 7 o'clock on Indivisible, I'm really excited to dig into this topic. You hear a lot of discussion about elites. It's kind of a code word for them, not us. President Trump uses the phrase a lot. And so we're going to dig into what that means and why that is... It kind of pushes back against the cohesiveness of a democracy. So that's coming up tomorrow night at 7 o'clock on Indivisible. You should listen Monday through Thursday if you can and call in.